From Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster and welcome to the Green Majority. This week, we've got a little bit of an out-of-order bit of a show today, but it should be fun. We're going to have Amara Poussin, who's with the Canadian Youth Climate Coalition, University of McGill, and about a dozen other things, coming to talk to us today about PowerShift. PowerShift is a very large, well, I guess the best thing to do is call it rally slash conference slash slash a whole bunch of slashes in there. It's basically a whole bunch of environmentally minded people from all over the country who get together and do like little workshops and they organize a bunch of rallies. It's basically a half a teach-in sort of conference and half activism rally out there in Ottawa. I went to the one back in 2009. I had a fantastic time, but Amara's going to come on and talk to us a little bit about what exactly they're doing this year. It sounds like every year they've been getting bigger and better, and boy, was it amazing when I was there. So we're going to talk to her about that. We're going to start off the program, though, with a look from the Post-Carbon Institute. We've got Richard Heinberg and Julian Darley, who got basically, they produced it back in 2008, but they basically it was a reasonably short explanation of exactly what peak oil was, and it's geared towards policymakers, but I think it's important for everyone to hear because it's not full of too much heavy jargon or anything like that. If anything, when you think a lot of the time, a lot of policymakers get their policy by lobbyists, and now that doesn't necessarily itself automatically apply that lobbyist is some sort of evil person. A lot of the times, this is the way that policy gets made, is people come in who have interest in it, and of course, when you're talking, for instance, about oil industry is interested in that issue. So they have an opportunity to talk to government about how their industry would be affected by certain policies. Now, a lot of environmental activists might say that they get preferential access to the government, and I think that we could definitely talk about that. But the way this is that if you sort of understand how policy is made, and you sort of realize that the policymakers themselves are not experts on these issues, which is why they go to places like, get access to by both, hopefully, as much as possible, the public and interested NGOs and stuff, but also industry itself. So we sort of, I think, as a group, have to stop thinking that policymakers, they made this decision because they have access to the best information, because they may, in fact, not. A lot of the time, in fact, their job is to not be an expert, but to discern between the information they've been presented with. And Richard Heinberg and Julian Darley would argue at the Post-Carbon Institute that the other side, if you will, has not been presented to policymakers. So we're actually going to start off with that clip. We'll be back afterwards to talk to Amara about PowerShift, and then Amara and Kevin Farmer, our house pundit, are going to wrap up the end of the show pretty much for that second half of the show there, and we're going to sort of tie all these issues together. But for now, we're going to go to Richard Heinberg and Julian Darley with the Post-Carbon Institute.
Hello, I'm Richard Heinberg of Post-Carbon Institute, author of Peak Everything and several other books that explore the challenges of energy resource depletion.
I'm Julian Darley, author of High Noon for Natural Gas and president of Post-Carbon Institute. For the next few minutes, we'll be speaking about an issue of overwhelming national and global significance: our oil supply, what we have now, and what we will have in years to come.
You may have heard of what some people call the peak oil theory, the understanding that the rate of world oil production will reach a maximum and begin to decline. Calling it a theory is only appropriate if we contrast it with a theory that oil is infinite and our supply will never decrease. But almost no one believes that. No, peak oil is not theoretical. It's not a matter of if, but when, and how to prepare.
As with any mineral resource, we first go after oil that's cheapest and easiest to find and extract. When this highest quality oil is used up, production slows, then declines, and may continue to tail off for many decades. This effect is seen in both individual oil fields and a country's total oil extraction rate.
For most of the last century, the U.S. was the undisputed champion of oil producers. For decades, we produced half the world's oil, and we're the world's foremost exporter. But our discoveries of oil began to dwindle back in the 1930s, and U.S. production hit its maximum in 1970. It has never recovered. We live in a post-peak oil country. After the 1970 domestic peak and the oil shocks that followed, we learned hard how dependent we were on oil imports. So we started exploring for more oil at home, and we found an enormous amount in new oil provinces in Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico. Those oil fields helped turn production around for a few years at a time during the past three decades. But Alaska itself is now in steep decline, and we're currently relying on the oil in the Gulf of Mexico to make up for falling output elsewhere.
In the past decade, the U.S. has doubled its number of drilling rigs, but still, deep water production from the Gulf of Mexico has plateaued and will start to decrease within the next few years. What if we drill in ANWR and off the coasts of California and Florida that are currently off limits? Let's use Department of Energy Reserves figures for those regions to see how long it would take to bring that oil to the market and how much difference it would make.
In 20 years, we could gain a couple of million barrels a day in production, which could be sustained for two decades or so. But by that time, production from our other fields would have fallen by about half. The result would be far from enough to end our dependence on imports, even temporarily. We wouldn't even be able to return to the level of domestic production we enjoy today.
Meanwhile, the same thing is happening to other oil-producing nations. Britain and Norway found a treasure trove of oil and gas in the North Sea in the 1970s, but production peaked for them at the beginning of this decade. Already, Britain has returned to being a net oil importer. In fact, Chevron, the International Energy Agency, and the U.S. Department of Energy say most countries are likewise seeing falling production. Every year, there are fewer oil exporters and more oil importers.
Sometimes novice commentators talk about peak oil as if it were a problem with oil reserves, but that's not accurate. Reserves can be estimated generously or conservatively, depending on what's counted and who's counting. Instead, peak oil is about production flow rates, and those can be measured accurately. Does this mean that we are at the peak of global oil flow rates now? Not necessarily. There are large new production projects coming online this year and next, including one in Saudi Arabia that will add several hundred thousand barrels a day to that nation's productive capacity. On the other hand, there are some new problems.
Russia, now the world's foremost oil-producing nation and the country that's been responsible for much of the world's oil production growth over the past decade, has entered its terminal decline. Other important exporting nations like Nigeria and Mexico are also in trouble. The industry is always finding new oil, but discoveries have been decreasing since about 1964. This is not a couple of years of bad luck. It's a well-established trend. Even when a sizable new oil field is found these days, it is almost always in ultra-deep water or another area that poses enormous technical challenges.
Some economists say that these high prices are largely due to the falling value of the dollar or to speculation. Simple math tells us that dollar depreciation has added only 10 to 15% to oil's cost over the past two or three years. As for speculation, we have to ask, why are investors parking their money in oil contracts? It must be because they see the fundamentals supporting rising prices. Demand is rising and supply isn't. So speculation is a symptom, not the cause of the problem.
Where is demand rising? In China and India, of course, but also in many of the oil-exporting nations. Demand is rising at a rate of up to 7% per year in some of these nations. The reason is plain. With oil prices so high, these countries are earning record amounts of foreign exchange income, which is causing their economies to grow. When consumption expands at 7% per year, this means that it will double in just a decade. So even as the Saudis add new production capacity, in the short run, about the best they can do is keep up with domestic demand growth. For other producer nations, even if production can be kept flat, which in most cases it can't, their exports will decline.
That's very bad news for the U.S., as we import almost two-thirds of the oil we use and are now competing with growing economies like China. World output of conventional crude has been flat for years now. However, with exports, we can already see the beginning of a downward slide. If current trends continue, exports could decline by half within a decade. This means we could face not just high prices, but actual shortages.
How serious a problem is this? The summary of the Department of Energy's study, known as the Hirsch Report, puts it like this. The peaking of world oil production presents the U.S. and the world with an unprecedented risk management problem. As peaking is approached, liquid fuel prices and price volatility will increase dramatically, and without timely mitigation, the economic, social, and political costs will be unprecedented.
They use the word unprecedented twice. They seem to be implying that this is a bigger problem than the Great Depression or World War II. After all, oil is our primary national energy source. It provides just about all our transportation energy and also fuels industrial agriculture. They go on.
Viable mitigation options exist on both the supply and demand sides, but to have substantial impact, they must be initiated more than a decade in advance of peaking.
In other words, the market won't solve this problem on its own. Price signals from scarcity will come years and decades too late to help us adapt. It will take time and enormous amounts of investment capital to rebuild the energy and transport infrastructure of a country like ours. Currently, our national energy policy is to import ever more oil while complaining about having to do so, and to hope for miracles.
The alternative energy sources we're investing in will not provide us with the fuel quantities at a speed and scale that we need. We should be investing not a few hundred million here and there, but hundreds of billions a year. Yes, that's right, hundreds of billions. And even then, it is now clear that there is no way that we will be able to develop other fuels fast enough to make up for declining petroleum. And what about conservation? Of course we need to increase the fuel efficiency of our vehicles. But the sheer size of the problem and the short time we have to adapt mean that this effort will also be too little, too late.
Instead, we need the level of response to meet the level of the crisis. Our current efforts are in the wrong direction. We've been spending hundreds of billions on expanding highways and airports, just as higher oil prices are assuring we will be using them less and less. We must change our priorities as a nation. And fast. We must shift into crisis mode as we did with the New Deal and the war effort in the 1940s. Serious fuel shortages may or may not appear this year or next, but they are inevitable within a very few years. To prepare, we need plans for fuel rationing. We need a strategy to keep emergency and food delivery vehicles on the road and to provide winter heating oil to the Northeast, while we make longer-term arrangements to reduce our need for oil.
Is what we are doing to mitigate climate change enough to solve the peak oil problem? Not by a long shot. We at Post Carbon Institute believe that climate change is the greatest environmental challenge in our species' history. But because some of the worst impacts are likely to appear decades from now, from a policy perspective, it constitutes a moral dilemma.
Peak oil presents us with more than a moral imperative. This is not about what we should do to save the polar bears. It's about what we must do to manage an unfolding national calamity. The disaster is already upon us, worsening by the year, the month, the day. We can survive this long emergency, as we did previous national crises, but it will take courage and effort.
If you are starting to feel really concerned about this problem, rest assured that you are in good company. Others who are speaking out about the oil supply crisis include the officials at the International Energy Agency, the CEO of the European oil company Total, and major figures within the oil industry. Sweden has recognized the perils of oil dependency and depletion and has made it a national priority to become petroleum-free by 2020. Here in the US, an increasing number of legislators and other policymakers are working to develop responses to peak oil. Cities are empaneling peak oil task forces and working out plans for oil reduction in their transport and food systems.
Please take the time to learn more about peak oil and how to develop policies that enable our nation to quickly reduce its dependence on depleting petroleum. Post Carbon Institute is working to identify policies that we believe will help both over the short term and the long term. Policies like the Oil Depletion Protocol, and programs like post-carbon cities. If you're a legislator, you can help by creating or joining a bipartisan peak oil caucus within your legislative body.
Peak oil is not a partisan political issue. It is a survival crisis that affects us all.
We must come together as a nation to quickly end our addiction to oil. As the International Energy Agency puts it, we must leave oil before it leaves us.
All right, so that was Post Carbon Institute Richard Heinberg and Julian Darley talking about peak oil, explaining exactly what it is and the sort of ideas that you have to have in mind when you're talking about these sorts of issues. Hopefully now you've got some talking points the next time somebody talks to you about buying their new gas-guzzling car or maybe why they don't think a hybrid makes sense, or perhaps you may even get as thick into it as talking to somebody on peak oil on the street. Now you've got your primer on the facts that you need to know to have that discussion. We're going to be back in a few minutes to talk to Amara Poussin about power shift, and then we'll be back with both of them after the national headlines to kind of generally discuss some of these issues and tie all of this together. For the time being, though, we're just going to take a quick music break. We'll be right back in a minute. All right, and we're back. I'm Darren Kaster. You are listening to The Green Majority. We're now going to be talking power shift, and I have Amara Poussin on the phone. Amara, am I mangling your last name?
It's pretty close. It's Poussin.
Poussin, all right. No, we've got the first thing out of the way. So I went to, I believe, the first power shift. That was 2009.
Yep.
I didn't realize it was the first one at the time because it was a pretty huge event. They had buses organized from the University of Toronto here where I was to take people up there, local campus groups kind of encouraging participation and sort of filing people onto these buses. I mean, even the first one was a massive, massive event. I hope you felt it was a massive success. But enough about my experiences. Do you want to just explain to the folks that weren't able to go in 2009, maybe haven't heard about it since then, exactly what is PowerShift?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's changed shape a bit since 2009, and one of the reasons you probably felt like it was such a big event in 2009 was because it was the first in Canada, but part of a global movement. So the first one that it actually happened was in 2006 in the U.S., and then it grew across the world. So there have been power shifts that have been held in the U.S., India, the U.K., Australia, and Canada. And so in 2009, a few of us who had gone to Power Shift U.S., got together over the summer and were like, oh, we should organize one here. And then over the course of 4 months, somehow pulled together the event you just described.
You guys pulled that together in 4 months? How many people were doing that? Like 200?
There was a core group of about 15 of us. And then, I mean, the people who put in the most work were the local organizers who did exactly what you said, bringing people on buses and finding funding so they could participate. But it was organized primarily by the Canadian Youth Climate Coalition. And this time around, we wanted to make sure that we brought together more of a broad coalition because really the intersecting group is youth, and while it's primarily environmental and climate focused, we wanted to make sure we were bringing people together around a range of issues. So we have a 12 organization organizing committee right now made up of a bunch of groups, including the Canadian Youth Climate Coalition, the Indigenous Environmental Network, 350.org, the Canadian Auto Workers Union. So it's really a broad group. And we're also, this time around, organizing Power Shift around a campaign to end $1.4 billion in fossil fuel subsidies. So it's basically the same kind of an event this time around. It's from Friday, October 26th to October 29th. 3 days of programming full of skills-based workshops that are organized around a communications track, a campaigns track, an education track, an investigation track, and an outreach track. Mm-hmm. And then frontline panels, so we can hear from those who are most impacted by climate change, issue-based workshops and panels, so again, we can look at impact, policy, solutions. We also have a number of regional identity and interest-based caucuses, and of course, we have some really exciting keynotes. So Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, who's a big student organizer here in Quebec, And used to be the spokesperson of CLAS, is going to be there, along with Melina Laucan Massimo, who's a member of the Lubicon Cree First Nation and has done a lot of really incredible work around the tar sands and climate and energy campaigning for Greenpeace. And also Bill McKibben, who founded 350 and was pretty instrumental in stopping the Keystone Pipeline. And then at the end of all of this, and this is something new, actually. We didn't do this in 2009. On Monday, October 29th, we're going to have a day of action where participants are going to be able to meet with their members of parliament and practice advocacy and lobby skills they've learned over the weekend and talk primarily about a bill to end the $1.4 billion in subsidies. And then at 11, we're going to have a march where, because it's Halloween 2 days later, we're going to go trick-or-treating around Ottawa with a demand that's much more serious than candy. We're trying to...
You're demanding organic candy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
and also ending fossil fuel subsidies.
And just throw that in at the end, sure.
Yeah. It's going to be really fun. We're encouraging people to dress up in costumes like the ghosts of environmental regulations past. Yeah, I'm pretty excited.
So, I mean, it really was as huge an event as it sounds there. One of the, just kind of from my experience when I went in 2009, was that, you know, you'd taken some space at the University of Ottawa there, and they had a whole range of classrooms. So I came in and was handed an itinerary. And to my surprise, you know, I was expecting, you know, something along, you know, at 10:30, we'll, you know, there's this presentation in this building. At, you know, 2:30, there's this presentation in this building. No. There is about 50 things happening at any given time. And it's basically this almost a whirlwind of excitement of walking from this workshop to that workshop and meeting all these great people. There was a number of ones that I really wanted to go and sit in on that I couldn't because there was someone else that I wanted to go in and sit on at the same time. Is it still so chaotic this year, or you still have so much planned?
Well, chaotic has a bit of a negative connotation.
Good chaos.
Definitely good chaos. So I mentioned those skills tracks, and there are five of them. I mean, you can obviously take workshops in any track, but we wanted to make sure that the programming was a little more focused. So if someone comes in and says, I really want to become a great communicator who knows how to do media work and tell my story for social change when I go back to my community, there's a suggested list of workshops that they can go to. But really, there's a huge diversity. So our campaigns track has everything from nonviolent direct action to building giant puppets. And our investigation track has everything from participatory research design to investigative journalism. There's a huge diversity in programming.
Okay, and then the last thing I wanted to ask you, we're gonna take our headline break, and then we're gonna come back and talk to you and Kevin Farmer a little bit, and we can kind of break this down a little bit more and talk about some of the specific issues like the oil subsidies after the break. But just before we go, you mentioned nonviolent direct action. One of the things that kind of also stuck in my craw. I mean, I had an amazing time. But just after I left, I remember after the weekend, there was some people that had stayed behind and ended up making the news about some folks had sort of stormed in and interrupted Parliament. I don't remember if it was Parliament they'd interrupted, but there was a bit of some noise that was seen from at least some angles as being less than constructive. I just wondered if you would comment a little bit on what sort of direct action you're talking about, whether or not you expect that sort of, you know, to what degree I feel like you feel that sort of plays a role. Not obviously not violence. Nobody is advocating violence, but that sort of kind of disruption, if that's sort of a part of direct action, or how you feel about that sort of action. Because in my personal opinion, I felt like that sort of tainted the end of the thing in 2009.
Right. Well, I mean, just commenting on that event specifically, I was in question period, and I didn't know what was going to happen. And I was fairly new to organizing at that time, and I was pretty upset afterwards. And it took me a few days to try to understand why they had done that. I mean, I personally at first felt like, similar to what you just described, I guess, like that it had tainted the event or something. But upon reflecting and upon attending the debrief that night with a bunch of people who had organized it pretty spontaneously, I realized that that happened because they felt like their voices weren't being heard. So in the lead-up to PowerShift 2009, we had written letters, we had done petitions, we had scheduled meetings with MPs, and I remember going to the meeting with my MP that day and feeling like I wasn't being listened to at all. So I think nonviolent direct action or other sorts of creative action are called for when people feel like nothing else is working. So that's just my personal reflection on that day. That was one of the moments where I realized that there are plenty of ways to make change. And we want to make sure that at PowerShift, we're discussing all of them There's no direct action planned for PowerShift. There's a march planned on the day of action. But it's definitely something we should talk about, because there's a whole spectrum of ways that we can create the positive change we want to see.
Sure, and I think the part that everybody can agree on is that, you know, whether or not, you know, I personally would have participated in that action, or what my personal feelings are on it are kind of irrelevant. I think the thing that everybody can kind of agree on was that if there was a conduit by which citizens and interested people could be heard by their members of parliament with the same degree, kind of looking back at the future that we just played, to the same degree which, for instance, as an example, the oil industry has access. As people that are affected equally but in different ways as the oil industry, then this sort of thing would not be necessary and nobody would be advocating for it.
Exactly, yep.
Okay. So with that note, we're gonna take a break for our headlines. We'll be back. We're gonna play a music track, which Amira, hopefully we're gonna hang up and we're gonna call you back. Listen to the music track though. I picked a special music track to play for our interlude today, and then after we do our headlines, we'll be back and talk to you and Kevin Farmer about some of these issues.
Great, thanks. We'll talk to you then.
Okay. So now
got my ear to the ground, looking over my shoulder. Prophecies are getting younger before they grow older. When duty calls,
all right. So now we're gonna do a quick break for our national headlines. I keep confusing myself here, Leah. This is Leah Mazzolini bringing us our national headlines for this week.
Environmental watchdog says the Liberal government is ignoring the public's right to be a part of the development of green policies. Environmental Commissioner Gord Miller announces his concern about the lack of interest being shown to the Environmental Bill of Rights on Wednesday, September 19th. Miller adds several ministries are turning a blind eye to the requirements of the law and developing unrealistic plans, policies, and programs without properly notifying or consulting Canadians. Miller specifically accuses the Ministry of Natural Resources for beating around the bush when it comes to obligations and should be pegged as a chronic offender. Miller also says the Ministry of Energy didn't post a full proposal notice on the Environmental Registry when it announced a review of its feed-in tariff program for green energy projects. Miller concludes members of the public service are ignoring the responsibility to support and implement the will of democracy. Atmospheric scientists from around the world are pleading Environment Canada to put a stop to what they believe would compromise ozone and radiation monitoring by putting it into the hands of an IT expert. On the eve of the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Montreal Protocol on Saturday, September 15th, scientists say that they're astounded to learn about the budget cuts and staffing changes made by the government. The protocol is an international treaty to reduce the ozone-depleting pollution in the atmosphere, and now the new person in charge of monitoring the air comes from an IT background. German atmospheric scientist Mark Weber says the IT professional is not qualified for the job because he needs to have a much stronger scientific standing. Weber and other scientists learned about staffing changes during the meeting about the ozone and ultraviolet radiation data center with Environment Canada officials at a recent conference in Toronto. Legislation surrounding endangered species is about to get revamped this fall. Environment Minister Peter Kent says he wants to spend the next few months making the Species at Risk Act more efficient. In particular, he wants the recovery plans in the legislation to consider whole ecosystems rather than just certain species. Kent adds that he's already made progress with wildlife experts and legal advisors about eliminating the weaknesses of the existing legislation, which was established by the former Liberal government in 2002. The existing law is meant to develop plans that protect animals such as grizzly bears, timber rattlesnakes, woodland caribou, whales, whooping cranes, screech owls, and many others. But an analysis done by several environmental groups argued that the federal government has been slow in putting animals on the list, developing recovery plans, and implementing those plans to protect habitat and restore fragile animal populations. And that's all for the national news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. So we're going to go now to a bit of a special music track. I'm going to geek out here for a little bit. If no one's ever gone to YouTube and typed in either Melody Sheep or Symphony of Science, then they've definitely been missing some geeky fun. I don't know if auto-tuning is still cool these days, but this guy, what he basically does is he goes and takes clips from various famous scientists and turns them into songs, basically. He's used people, for instance, like Carl Sagan, David Attenborough, and stuff like that. So today we have one, and I've always been itching to play it on the show before, but he never normally deals with directly environmental stuff. Normally, it's just kind of general science advocacy. But finally, he must have heard my psychic requests. He made a piece that came out about 6 days ago. You can find this on YouTube under Symphony of Science or Melody Sheep. This piece is talking about climate change. It's featuring people like Bill Nye, David Attenborough, Richard Alley, and Isaac Asimov, the famous science advocate, science and famous science writer. So take it away. This is Melody Sheep.
We are a flexible and innovative species, and we have the capacity to adapt and modify our behavior. Now, we most certainly have to do so if we're to deal with climate change. It's the biggest challenge we have yet faced.
The same thing that keeps the Earth warm, CO2, may make the Earth too warm. It holds in heat. Methane, chlorofluorocarbons, carbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide. They all trap heat. Methane, chlorofluorocarbons, carbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide. They all trap
heat. It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes. We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers for these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Every single thing every one of us does,
affects everybody all over the world.
It's one global ecosystem.
Warm, wet, cold or dry, climates all start in the sky. Warm, wet, cold or dry, climates all start in the sky.
When the CO2 is high, the temperature is high, moving together in lockstep. When the CO2 is low, the temperature is low. Moving together.
It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers for these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Our use of fossil fuels for energy is pushing us towards a climate unlike any seen in the history of civilization.
Adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere warms things up.
The rise in CO2
comes from burning fossil fuels.
When you burn them, add oxygen and the CO2 that goes in the air.
We're reversing the process by which they form.
We're talking about something that affects the entire Earth. Problems that transcend nations.
It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers for these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
All right. Again, this is Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. If you have already been paying attention, thank you for letting me nerd out there for a minute. But I really like that guy's work. Again, if you liked that song, he has a lot of other stuff. Most of it has to do with environment. A lot of it's kind of general science advocacy with cool people like Isaac Asimov, David Attenborough, and my personal hero, Carl Sagan. You can check him out on YouTube. That's Melody Sheep, or just Google or YouTube Symphony of Science. He's got some neat stuff on there. However, we're going to come back now. I should have Kevin Farmer on the line. Are you there, Kevin? Kevin, are you there? Okay, maybe I have Amira on the phone. Do I have either people on the phone?
You have me.
Amira, okay. Well, I'll get Ryan to work on getting Kevin. We may have lost him for a second. But I don't suppose you were able to hear the track that we just played.
Sort of. It was a little fuzzy on the phone, but I, at the same time, Googled Melody Sheep.
So it's kind of one of those ideas where, you know, at the same point, and I think that was sort of the theme that I was going with a little bit today, was that, you know, we have some major issues in general. That's the reason that we do this show, that we have to deal with the environment, but that it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, all glum. We talk about on the show sometimes about, you know, things like activist burnout or the feeling of helplessness that people generally have. And I think that was a lot of what the idea behind Power Shift was to give people the energy to and the confidence, and not just the information, but the energy to maybe find some practical ways to deal with some of these problems.
Yeah, exactly. So bringing a bunch of people together, giving them the skills they need to succeed, but also connecting them. You know, so our plan for Power Shift doesn't end at Power Shift. We want people to go back home and mobilize in their communities, ideally with the people that they've met at the conference.
Absolutely. And I believe we have Kevin on the line there now. Kevin, are you there?
Hi, Darren.
Absolutely. All right. Minor technical difficulties. So we were just kind of just what I wanted to do now was sort of talk just generally about some of the ideas. And Amira, we can certainly keep mentioning Power Shift, but just the change focus a little bit from the event itself to some of the things that Power Shift is going to be dealing with. And I know Kevin had a particular issue today that he wanted to bring up. If you want to go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I just wanted to bemoan in general the complete and mystifying political inertia regarding taking any kind of action on climate change. You know, just looking back over the summer we just had, two-thirds of the United States was under drought conditions, food prices went up, I was at my cottage north of Kingston, and the water in the lake was extremely low. I've never seen it so low. And it just sort of brought it home, you know, that what we're seeing is exactly what the climate change models have always been predicting. We're seeing droughts, we're seeing forest fires, we're seeing an increase in the severity of storms and the frequency of storms. And to go through the drought-like conditions that we just went through this summer, and to not see that as a warning sign to a threat, a vital existential threat to our ability to grow food, just completely blows my mind. And I'm here to start today to just kind of remind people to, you know, look up the email address of your MP and you know, and email the PMO and just let people know that you want action taken on climate change. The Harper government is never going to lift a finger. They're moving in the opposite direction. They're closing down scientific research on the topic. And it's just, you know, the signs are all around us. We can see it happening right now. It's no longer a boogeyman of the future. It's occurring right now, and it's threatening civilization. You can't have civilization without the ability to grow food, especially on a planet as crowded as this one. And if we can't take that threat seriously, then we deserve what we get.
So, Amira, I started off the beginning of the program with a clip we played from the Post Carbon Institute, with them explaining sort of from a policymaker standpoint, just even the specific issue of peak oil, which is one of the many kind of bricks in the climate change castle, as it were. But one of the preamble that I gave there was around the idea that policymakers, a lot of the time, people assume that, you know, people in government are their job. So the person who's in charge of the environment office at whatever given time, you know, is put that in that position because they're an expert on the environment. But as far as I understand, in reality, that's not necessarily true. A lot of the time, they're actually quite, you know, maybe have some experience in that field, but they're largely ignorant and rely on things like lobbyists and the public and briefs from government scientific and policy research agencies to give them the information about which is based on their to base their jobs and what they exactly do. And so I think one of the things that I find unconstructive is when I hear people talk about, government isn't entirely corrupt and this is just a big old boys club and thing. And I don't disagree that there's probably a component of that. But I think to another degree, you know, when we talk about activist burnout or people feeling the, as you said, Kevin, the inertia of not knowing what to do and or the problem seeming too big and therefore people just end up doing nothing. I want to just make the appeal here that that affects, you know, people in government, whether we like to think of them all the time as this way or not, are people too, and therefore are still subject to, I don't know what to do about this, therefore I'm just going to keep doing what I've always been doing because, you know, I have some incentives to do that and I don't know how to deal with the problem even if I was going to deal with it. I just wondered if I could get a comment from you on that, Amira.
Sure. I mean, I think the climate crisis that we're talking about here and the science behind it isn't disputed. The science is very clear. There was a pretty terrifying, actually, article by Bill McKibben in Rolling Stone a couple of weeks ago that basically said that we're planning to burn 5 times the amount of carbon that we have the room to burn. There's absolutely no choice but to shift away. The question we need to ask ourselves is, why is our government, instead of shifting away, choosing to continue building pipelines, continue giving fossil fuel companies $1.4 billion a year? It's not even like, I guess if there is the acknowledgement that the science is clear, which I think there is, why are we continuing to invest in this infrastructure that's going to lock us into expanding the tar sands and continuing to burn fossil fuels and extract fossil fuels? And then I think when you look at it that way, it's what you were saying earlier about lobbying. It's pretty clear who has preferential access to the government and who is dictating the government's policy. And that's not because MPs are bad people. It's because of who has the access, who has the money. The citizens don't have the kind of organized money to influence government, which is why we need organized people. And well, I guess that's my power shift plug. But the relentless drive to put short-term economic profit over the interests of our communities, of the environment, is what's causing the problem. It's the same cause of the economic crisis. Yeah, it's pretty clear to me. I don't think emailing our MPs is going to stop it. I think we need to get organized and start building alternatives in our community and finding creative ways to put pressure on decision makers.
Sure. I mean, that being said, for your average person or for instance for someone who doesn't have the time, money, or energy to go out and join something like PowerShift or join a larger organization, I certainly think, like, you know, 100,000 people that can't attend PowerShift sending an email to their MP is probably a good place to start. It at least lets them know that it's not just the 20 people banging on their door of their office that are concerned about it, but that those 20 people represent a larger, you know, understanding of the citizens of Canada.
Yeah, of course.
That was sort of your power shift answer. Can I ask you to not speak for CYCC? Just to ask your personal opinion. In your own words, where do you find that problem lies? Where for you does the balance in your experience between inertia based on ignorance and inertia based on, you know, perhaps going up to corruption, but maybe just, we'll say, influence at the very least end. Having dealt with government officials several times before, do you feel like there's more of a balance towards they're just ignorant of the fact that there's a problem, ignorant of the fact that maybe they know there's a problem, but they're ignorant of the solutions, to just it's easier to not to do anything about it, it's put it on the problem on someone else, to all the way at the other far end to just outright corruption? Where on the line in your experience would you put why we haven't been making some of these changes?
I mean, I think on the government side, it's what I said earlier. I think the people influencing the policy are the ones with the most money and the most vested interest in the status quo. And based on meetings with government officials, meetings with Canada's lead negotiators who are going to the UN, where we've presented alternative policy positions and solutions, they know it's the problem, they know the science is clear, and they know what they could do about it, and they'll be the first ones to tell you that that what they have to negotiate is dictated by a couple of people at the top. And it's completely political. Then the question is, what do we do about that? And I think the average person doesn't necessarily know what to do. So the news is telling you that Arctic ice melt has reached an all-time high, extreme weather is costing us billions of dollars, it's pretty gloomy. Then you ask yourself, what do we do? You send an email to your MP, nothing happens. You keep engaging with the system in ways where they've set the rules. So they say, okay, maybe if you email me, I'll do something about it. Write a petition, I'll do something about it. And then when that doesn't work, we just try it again. That's not working. I think we just need to get creative. So whether that's figuring out how to start a community energy project or taking action in another way, it's giving people the tools and the time that they need to get organized together and build a solution. And I totally hear what you're saying about not everyone having the time to do that, and that's fine, because we can all contribute to it in different ways. If there are a few people emailing an MP, and then in that MP's riding, there's a community energy project springing up, there are ways for them to work together to make it impossible for the MP to say no to the project.
And I think under what you're talking about organizing is, you know, a way to do this, if there's, say, 20 interested people, I mean, obviously there's a lot more, but just to keep it simple, say there's 20 interested people and 15 of them don't have time to, you know, actually go and do anything, or maybe aren't motivated to actually do anything, but they're willing to, say, write an email to their MP, and then you've got five folks who want to go down and actually speak to the MP or you know, stand outside their office or whatever it may be, is that one of the ways that we're kind of organizing around doing this is to, you know, organize it such that those 15 people that send emails, send them all in the same day, the day before that the five people show up at the office, such that you sort of have a more of an impact from those emails rather than an email every 3 days in between 700 emails from the oil lobbyists, as far as being that sort of idea. Kevin, I want to get your input on that as well, having heard Amara's response. So if the minimum people can do is send an email, then definitely go ahead and send an email. But where do you see there being maybe some real traction here, kind of on actually getting some changes happening based on what Amara said?
Well, you know, ultimately this is a political problem. Like, to go back to what you're saying, you know, ministers are humans too, and perhaps they're ignorant on the topic. I'd like to just sort of point out that the Harper government is becoming willfully ignorant. They're closing monitoring stations. They're stifling press releases from their own, from government scientists on topics like climate change. They, you know, just look at what they did to the long form census. They want to build prisons, but crime is going down. Well, get rid of the statistics that say crime is going down and build the prisons anyway. Like, they're willfully ignorant, and especially so on the topic of climate change. And as to what gets traction, you know, especially when you're dealing with a government like Harper's that is, like I said, you know, has chosen to become willfully ignorant on the topic of climate change. You know, we've got to start voting the environment. There's just no other way around it. The grassroots actions are great, and people are buying into it. You know, people are sort of on a grassroots level buying into the environment, but these issues are too large for sort of the you know. To be solved by an aggregate of small actions. We need national leadership. We need national programs. We need national targets for carbon emissions. We need national strategies. We need the tax code. We need to put a price on carbon, which can't be accomplished sensibly on a province-by-province basis without discouraging, without ramifications for business investment. We need to start voting the environment, and we need to especially get over this false dichotomy that it's either the environment or the economy. You know, as soon as the environment has been tracking higher and higher in recent polls as a top of mind issue in the elections, but as soon as there's a ripple in the economy, people go freaking and running in the other direction and start voting what they perceive to be, you know, the steady path for economic stewardship, which in this case bought us a Harper majority, and it's a false dichotomy, and it's not a choice between the environment and the economy. In fact, without a functioning environment, there is no economy. We just go back to what I said about being able to grow food. What will happen to our economy when there's a drought over our breadbasket? So we need to. You know, ultimately, I think the solutions are political. I think we need to do. We need. You know, the Green Majority is doing its part in trying to educate people with regards to what's going on in the world with respect to environmental issues, and hopefully, you know, people are going to start voting I say green, not meaning the Green Party, but voting green in the sense that they're going to vote for the, you know, the party with the strongest environmental platform.
Could I respond to that?
Please, go ahead.
Kevin, I feel like what you're saying is that we just need to give up our agency, you know, like vote once every few years and trust that the decision makers are going to do it for us. And I mean, of course we should vote, but I don't think it ends there, because just focusing on voting reinforces the kind of inertia that we've been talking about, where people feel like the only legitimate way to engage with their decision makers or engage in democracy is to check something off at the ballot box. And that's not true. And if that were true, even if the more progressive parties were elected, they probably still wouldn't be doing enough. There needs to be pressure. There needs to be, like, we still need community projects. We still need grassroots movements. If there's one thing that the students in Quebec have shown us, it's that direct democracy can work, and that mass mobilization can actually make a difference.
One of the things, one of the news stories we covered about a year ago that I think is very relevant here was there was an MP from Quebec, actually, who came out speaking very publicly about, he made a comment, I forget the actual specifics of the event, but made a very public comment about how he thought climate change was a hoax. And this was, you know, very recently. And it was amazing how quickly the, he was a conservative MP, and amazing how quickly the Harper government sort of distanced himself / made public statements about, we don't support this and whatnot. And I think there's one of two kind of conclusions that can be taken from that. Either they understand that climate change is an extremely real threat, and that there is, you know, a massive amount of science behind it, and that this is a very legitimate issue. They're simply choosing not to do anything about it, but they do recognize that it is an actual fact. Or the other possibility that I see is that they aren't even thinking about it in terms of, is this a fact or is this not a fact? It's that they simply are thinking about it in terms of voters, and that they understand / think that voters see this as a legitimate issue, and they dare not badmouth it openly because of a voting backlash. And I think that if the second one is true, I think they're both true, but I think the second one is the important point there, is that kind of as a summation of what you're both saying there, is that, you know, yes, of course, you have to vote for the most progressive option that's there as far as environment, because it does relay back to the economy and it does relay back to all these other issues. But I think, Amara, what you're saying is that in between voting, you have an ability to actually affect what are in those platforms when it comes time to vote on them. And the only way that you're going to give even people who, you know, with the... say the famous failure of the carbon tax, the Liberal platform a couple of years ago, was that the parties need to be convinced, they need to be given the confidence that people are actually going to support these policies before they have the courage to present these policies. And I think that's more what you're speaking to. Am I sort of close, Samara?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm saying. And I think, Kevin, what you said about the false dichotomy between environment and economy, that's something that the Harper government has done very well, setting up that dichotomy in order to be able to campaign on the economy as something that will suffer if we take action on the environment. It's a very deliberate political choice that they don't want to take action on the environment for whatever reason. I personally think it's because the oil companies run their platform, but that the only reason they would create that false dichotomy is because they want to be able to drive their economic platform.
Yeah, and I think we're just running out of time here. Kevin, I'll give you a quick last word in a second, but I think the kind of point here that we're all trying to make is that, you know, this is really irrelevant, you know, which party you're talking about. You could be a Conservative voter, you can be a Liberal voter, you can be an NDP voter, you can be a Green Party voter. It doesn't really matter. If any of these parties saw that it was to their political advantage, that it would get them votes to have green aspects to their platforms, they would have it in about 0.2 seconds. And that doesn't, it really doesn't matter what political party you're talking about, you know, and I think that was sort of what I was getting at with that point about the Conservative MP being backed away from very, very quickly when he was saying that climate change was a hoax, because they recognized that message is not going to resonate with the majority of even their voters. But anyway, Kevin, I'll give you we've got about a minute left. I'll give you the last word.
Well, just to speak to something that your guest commented on, I'd hate to be perceived as discouraging community activism and grassroots activism with regards to environmental issues. Certainly, like but I believe they're effective when they're sort of lobbying efforts and when they do what you're saying, showing politicians that it's in their best interest to provide us with green policies and a green platform. Grassroots activism is important. You know, it's a fundamental tenet of the environmental movement to think globally and act locally. So I would hate to be perceived as discouraging those kinds of actions. But I think ultimately they have to be aimed at altering the political structure to be effective.
All right. And so that is all the time that we have. I want to thank our guests very much again, Amira, for joining us with CYCC and PowerShift. Do you want to give us the website quickly for PowerShift?
Sure, yeah. It's wearepowershift.ca, and the email address for the Toronto group is toronto.powershift@gmail.com.
Awesome.
Well, organizing free buses.
We've talked a lot about some of the issues that's going on. Amira gave us a very good option about one of the ways to deal with that problem. That is all the time we have for today's show. Thank you again to Kevin Farmer as well for joining us, who will be regularly back on our program, thankfully to hear from that, so that it's not just me talking on my own for the end of the program here. However, that is all the time we have for this week's show. Don't forget, we'd love to hear feedback from our listeners. You can email us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com, join our Facebook fan page, and stay tuned to our website. We are in the process now of rebuilding a new powerful and wonderful website, so stay tuned for that. You've been listening to The Green Majority. I'm Darren Kaster. Canada's All Environmental News Hour program is produced live every Friday at CIUT and is available on campus and community stations from coast to coast. That's it for this week's program. Thanks for listening.